Okay, the recording has started. So hello to everybody and welcome. I'd like to open this session with an invitation to distance education researchers. I'm currently building the schedule for the fall, so if you or a colleague have a research project that you'd like to share with the CIDR community, I invite you to contact me so that we can discuss a presentation in the future at a CIDR session. And here is my email. It's in the text box for you. I'd also like to remind everyone that this CIDR session will be recorded and available from the CIDR site. So if you'd like to go back to review the session, or you know of a colleague who wished to attend today but wasn't able, I'm going to post the link to the recordings in the text box so you can use it or pass it on. There we go. Now, I'd like to introduce our presenter for today, Dr. Norm Friesen. Dr. Friesen is the Canada Research Chair in e-learning practices at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, British Columbia. Dr. Friesen is the author of several editions of books on the effective use of instructional software and on the implementation of technical standards for online collections of educational resources. He is also the author of Rethinking E-Learning Research, Foundations, Methods, and Practices, which we'll be discussing today. He's the co-editor of the online peer-reviewed journals E-Learning and Phenomenology and Practice. His research interests include the application of qualitative research to e-learning, media literacies, and alternative pedagogies. Dr. Friesen is also a member of the Canadian delegation to the International Standards Organization Subcommittee for Learning, Education, and Training, which produces international technical standards for e-learning systems. Now, during the presentation, you're invited to ask questions by using the hands up signal, which is in the bottom left corner of the participant box. It's the little hand with the up arrow next to the smileys. And you just have to click on, that's the one, click on that, and the system will let Dr. Friesen know that you have a question. I'm going to clear that right now. Okay. Now, we encourage you to use the audio and your microphone when you're posing questions, and you can do that by clicking on the microphone icon in the bottom left corner of the screen to talk. And then please remember to click on it again when you're done talking, and that releases the mic. If you don't have a microphone or if it's not working, you can text your questions and comments, and I'll try to bring those to Dr. Friesen's attention. Now, I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Friesen, to this CIDR session, and I'll hand the mic over to you.
Thanks very much, Lynn, for that introduction. Let me just begin by getting some feedback on my audio, because we were testing that before, but I want to make sure that it's working as well as we can reasonably get it to work this time. Good. I see Peggy and a couple of other people are indicating that it's fine, so I'm glad to see that. Somebody's raised their hand. Let me just give up the mic for 1 second and let Adrian. I gave up the mic for a second, but Adrian whoever else is interested in asking a question or making a point or about audio or about the contents of my presentation, please feel free to do so, and I'll be happy to let you speak up. However, you might need to give me a minute just to deal with the technical stuff and the to finish up any thought that I might be expressing at the time. So, as Lynn mentioned, I recently came out with a book called Rethinking E-Learning Research, and my talk today is going to focus on that book. Great, thanks, Lynn. For your technical help. So I'm going to be talking about, in some ways, introducing the book, introducing some of the most basic kind of theses or understandings that lay at the foundation of the book. And what I'm going to do and what that involves is a discussion about e-learning principally. Because when we're talking about e-learning research and rethinking e-learning research and looking at the way that e-learning research is thought of today or has been thought of in the past, it's important to understand, of course, first of all, what e-learning is and how it as a field of practice and of research is constituted. So I'm going to talk about, you know, sort of the interdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary configuration that's part of e-learning. Talk about the foundational role of psychology in the way that e-learning is defined, and talk then about e-learning research and development and how it relates to practice. Because as Lynn mentioned at the very outset, my position is titled Research Chair in E-Learning Practices, and of course that the term practice is in the title of the book as well. And it's a very important term and a very challenging one in some ways, ambiguous and important in its ambiguity. So again, if you have any questions or concerns or feedback to give me during the presentation, please please do feel free to do so, and I'll accommodate you as best I can. So first of all, where did the term e-learning come from, and how has its use been developing? E-learning, if you look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, was first used in the mid-1990s with the rise of the internet as a popular medium, and it was used as a shortened form of electronic learning. So the word electronic is pretty broad, but of course at that time it was referring to these new primarily digital forms of technology and of communication that were becoming really important and, you know, presenting the prospect of revolutionizing education, really. And of course, e-learning, even though the word suggests a focus on learning, it doesn't just refer to, you know, a particular kind of learning, but rather to education, teaching, design, and research, and both theory and practice in those areas. And since in the last, you know, 15 years or so, the word e-learning has come to represent a useful shorthand for a range of different orientations to research and to the use of technologies in education and learning. So e-learning, as I'll show in the next couple of slides, is used in a bunch of different ways, and it covers quite a wide range, you know, when viewed overall or altogether of practices, concerns, technologies. So just to illustrate how wide this is and how adaptable the term is, I provide two examples of how it's used in quite different ways. Both of these sources were published in 2003, and the first one is from Richard E. Mayer and Ruth Colvin Clark, two people who have been quite significant in educational technology and instructional design research and development. And they talk about e-learning as being something that should promote psychological engagement between the learner and the lesson content in ways that help learners select, integrate, and retrieve new knowledge. So what we have in this example of the use of the term e-learning is a focus on the interaction between an individual learner and content that's presented through, whether it's over the internet or otherwise through a computer system. Garrison and Anderson are quite different in their emphasis on e-learning. In their book, E-Learning in the 21st Century, they talk about e-learning as being unique in its ability to bring together a community of learners, so multiple learners, unrestricted by time or place. So you have two definitions of, or two ways of talking about e-learning that are almost in some ways mutually exclusive. One of them is saying, well, it's all about bringing learners together, and the other one is saying it's all about presenting content to an individual learner. And of course, it's relatively, the way e-learning is used more often, it actually encompasses both of those things. So for example, in the Handbook of Educational Technology and Communication that was published at the end of 2007. Rob Koper defines e-learning, for example, as the use of information and communication technologies, or ICTs, to facilitate and enhance learning and teaching. And other, I'm trying to remember the name of this, the source that I got this second quote from, but another book that has e-learning in its title talks about e-learning as marshalling computer and network technologies to the task of education. So it includes a whole bunch of things, really. It is about the internet, using the internet in learning and teaching, especially the web. And and web technology, of course, continues to change. And so we have terms like e-learning 2.0, edupunk, connectivism, a whole range of terminology that in some ways can be understood as contributing to the overall sort of set of discussions about e-learning and helping to define the field. Somebody just mentioned that was asking about the title of my book, and the book that I'm talking about is called Rethinking E-Learning Research. And the subtitle is Foundations, Methods, and Practices. It's from Peter Lang. It's published this year, and it came out right at the beginning of the year, and you can look it up on Amazon and read more about it there. You can also, oh, by the way, let me just sort of skip back here. You can also go to the website elearn.tru.ca. At this website that is at the bottom of the first slide of my talk, you can actually find an overview of the book, a list of all the chapters in the book, and even download a couple of sample chapters as well. So I encourage you to check that out and to make a note of that URL. So I'll just go back to where I was. So the question is then, how is this field constituted in terms of the other fields that I mentioned at the outset are related to it, above all psychology? Well, the one way you can understand it is that within the range of educational disciplines that make up the field of education, both in terms of, you know, educational practice and educational research and theory, e-learning can be understood as kind of a place where educational technology and distance education overlap. And also, that's in some ways a central part of e-learning, but it also extends into the use of educational technology, you know, in the classroom where the internet or the web or just simply or mobile technologies or standalone computers are being used to enhance teaching and learning or to support teaching and learning. And of course there are other areas of educational technology that aren't electronic or aren't digital that would still be included under the field of educational technology but not be included under e-learning. Similarly, in distance education, there's practices and media that are used, like print, of course, and that sort of thing, that are not, again, part of this these digital technologies that are central to e-learning. Now, important for educational technology, e-learning, and distance education are educational psychology and instructional design, and they inform these fields overall, and are in some ways especially important, I would say, in e-learning and educational technology. This diagram maybe should even show instructional design and educational psychology as kind of at the foundation of, or providing a foundation, methodological or disciplinary foundation for e-learning. They've become that important, especially in the case of educational psychology. So that's why I'm going to focus on psychology now for a little bit, because any kind of thinking or rethinking about e-learning research will require some discussion of psychology and some way of making explicit some of the psychological assumptions that are part of that are foundational to the field of e-learning. So it's fairly familiar or commonplace to say that there are three psychological paradigms or learning theories that are foundational to e-learning and to understanding educational practices even more generally. The first of these is behaviorism. And it's a psychology that studies behavior in terms of stimulus and response, and that understands teaching and learning in terms of processes of conditioning and control. And the reason that I'm running through these is to talk about and to show how each psychology frames educational questions and educational research in slightly different ways, but also to show how there are certain commonalities that have limited our understanding of what practice and research can mean in a field like e-learning. So cognitivism was popular from the 19 or was important from the 1960s to about the 1990s, and I should mention too that it still remains important today, because in many ways the next the third psychology or learning theory integrates many insights from cognitivism. So cognitivism understands the mind in computational terms, and sees teaching and learning as being about deep information processing or deep processing, and about the development, correction and development, correction and testing in some ways of representations in the mind. These ideas still remain important in constructivism, which became really important in the 1990s, and but which shows some signs of weakening in its influence as we reach the end of the first decade in 2000. It's a type of psychology or a type of approach to learning that looks at processes of individual and social construction, of course, and it sees teaching and learning as knowledge construction, and it builds on the idea, of course, that that the construction of representations in the mind of the learner through individual interaction with content and interaction with others as being the way that learning occurs. And of course, the role of the teacher is to then facilitate engagement with knowledge and with information with others in a way that these constructions are as well developed and as accurate or as well constructed as possible. So there have been some other approaches that have gained attention, and it leads one to think that we're kind of in a point of transition between to a new learning theory, but it's not clear what that's going to be. So I've heard many people talk about connectivism that has been developed by George Siemens originally, and that's also been developed further and promoted by Stephen Downs. There's also mention of functional contextualism, which is a way of predicting behavior. It kind of in some ways goes back to behaviorism. But it's not clear what the future holds in terms of learning theories. This slide essentially sort of, repeats some of the points of the previous slide, but also points out that the learning sciences also represent an approach that's currently significant. But one of the things to remember with the learning sciences, is that in some ways it's very much an eclectic approach that integrates together the contributions of a number of different fields. So that would include or a number of different understandings of research and of teaching and learning. So that includes things like design-based research, sciences about concerning the brain, and also even cognitivism as well. So the question is, given the fact that that e-learning and our understanding of education and instructional design educational technology have over the years been influenced by these learning theories, it's important to think about what's common to these theories and how they've shaped our understanding of the use of technology in education, I guess, overall. Well, first of all these understandings, maybe with the exception of connectivism, show a really distinct tendency to appeal to natural science and experimental methodology. So, you know, having a control group and manipulating, you know, a controlled variable as the way of developing theory. So that's certainly the case with behaviorism. And the types of controls and conditioning that Skinner, for example, understood as being central to behaviorism. It's the case with cognitivism, in which hypotheses about the mind and computer models of the mind would be tested by being put to use and being applied to particular computational tasks. It's also the case for constructivism, where a great deal of research has used experimental methods to understand or to measure the effects of constructivist pedagogies. There's also significant reference in all three cases to technological metaphors as a basis for theory. And so with behaviorism, the technological metaphor or inspiration were telephone networks and simple circuitry. Pavlov referred to that as an important way of understanding the mind, and also J.B. Watson, who together with Thorndike established helped to lay the groundwork for behaviorism, also made those kind of comparisons. In cognitivism, it's even clearer, of course. Like the whole idea of cognitive learning theory is that the mind is a computer. Constructivism, the issue, of course, is mental representations, and again, the computer serves as an important inspiration for a significant inspiration for understanding how representations can be. Constructed and manipulated and even simply represented. Connectivism, for its part, refers to networks and nodes and relies essentially on using, you know, the internet and other types of networks as a metaphor for understanding knowledge and learning. And other metaphors can be found for some of the other examples that I provided as well, in terms of you know, existing, established, and emerging theories of learning. In using technology as a metaphor, though, they generally understand technology as being kind of a neutral instrument that can facilitate learning, however it's understood. But one of the really key themes of my book, in some ways, is that confirmed the basic premise that there is essentially one way of knowing. So, you know, we construct representations, we process information, our behavior reveals, you know, is an indicator of what we know, and it's developed through conditioning and stimulus and response. And all knowledge can be understood in, you know, those terms. And one of the things that I try to argue in my book is that it can be really valuable to think about knowledge not as being one thing that is constructed or one thing that is processed or that is reinforced or that is assembled or connected together. Instead, I make the case that knowledge is something that's multiple, and that I'll just skip this slide, and that there are a number of different ways of understanding the multiplicity of knowledge. So this slide that I've moved to here is a slide that just presents one possible way of understanding the multiplicity of knowledge. It's a slide that's taken from a book that looks at what's called critical theory, and it represents a summary of Jürgen Habermas's knowledge types that Habermas discusses in a book called Knowledge and Interests. And so what this chart and what this typology of knowledge shows is that there are a number of fundamental human interests. Corresponding to those are a number of different knowledge types, and then there's different ways in which knowledge is worked with, and different kind of sciences or ways of understanding and ways of researching and both establishing and challenging this type of knowledge. So the first type is technical knowledge. And Habermas says that this type of knowledge, of course, is indispensable in developing technologies, in empirical, analytical, or natural sciences, and that it's based on the notion of causal explanation. And Habermas says that the medium through which this knowledge actualized is in terms of work. So it's practical knowledge in the sense of making technologies work, designing technologies. It's important in a person using them as well. And one of the things that this type of knowledge strives for is optimal efficiency. And it is a type of knowledge that that looks at things like outcomes and how they're measured, and how different types of instrumental variations can change those outcomes and hopefully improve them and optimize them and make them more efficient. Practical knowledge, which is the second knowledge type, is really quite different. The focus is in some ways more on everyday understanding. So, it's the kind of knowledge that we use when we, decide to take an umbrella outside or not, looking up at the sky. Of course, it could interact in some ways with technical or scientific knowledge if you bring a lot of background of in meteorology behind you, or if you're listening to a meteorologist on the news. But in terms of meeting other people, saying hello in the morning, and even doing things that are much more complicated, like reading a novel or understanding some text, all of those things have to do with language, of course, and they involve a very different type of knowing. And Habermas refers to that as hermeneutic knowledge and hermeneutic approach to knowing and understanding. And the way that that works, and I explain that in the chapter in my book on narrative, is that it's essentially a cyclical process through which one looks at any part of a text or any part of or any one aspect of one's experience, and then looks at a larger whole and compares the two, and that's a process that keeps on going and doesn't necessarily reach any definitive end, unlike something in the natural sciences where of course you can settle an argument once and for all. And then Habermas identifies a third type of knowledge, which is emancipatory knowledge, and it identifies also emancipatory human interest, and that refers, of course, to everybody's interest and motivation to be able to express themselves, to be able to act autonomously, and to be able to be treated with fairness and with justice. And Habermas identifies the critical sciences, by which he means critical theory, essentially his own theory and those of others who identify themselves as being critical theorists and even critical pedagogues would be included in that group. The key so much, of course, though, is not to sort of say, well, okay, there's three types of knowledge and now we need to understand knowledge in terms of these three. I'm not so much making the case that this needs to now replace ways that we've understood knowledge previously in e-learning or in distance education or educational technology. Instead, the case that I'm trying to make is that there are different ways of understanding knowledge, and that one of the things that I think has been challenging for people who are engaged in research and practice in e-learning is that we've tried to, in some ways, have all the different types of knowledge, whether that's scientific knowledge or quasi-experimental results, whether it's students' knowledge, somebody in grade one trying to understand how what gravity is and how it works, and also trying to understand even everyday interaction and online discussion, all using the same rubric of knowledge. Those three different types, or those three examples, are all involved quite different approaches to knowledge, and can be understood as kind of, you know, fitting together or being different in a number of different ways. So another example that I provide of the multiplicity of knowledge in my book is Jerome Bruner's understanding of narrative, and the narrative versus what Bruner calls the logico-scientific mode of knowledge. And narrative knowledge represents, of course, for Bruner, the kind of everyday or hermeneutic knowledge that Habermas is talking about, or is defining in this chart. And logico-scientific knowledge, of course, would fit more with the technical type of knowledge. So there's different ways of understanding the multiplicity of knowledge, but what's important is to, in my mind and in the book, is to at least consider very seriously the idea that knowledge may be multiple and that may have more than one form. So maybe I should just pause for a second and ask if there's any questions or any comments that I can respond to. So I'll give up the mic just for a few seconds and see if anybody has anything to say. Lynn, if everything's going well, maybe let me know about that, and I'll just do a little check-in.
Hi, so far everything's great. Oh, I see someone's got their hand up here. I'm just going to check who it is. And also Wendy had made a comment on a study that she's doing. Sorry, I can't see this. I'm scrolling through the participants here. Sorry, it's Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, first of all, I thank you very much for drawing attention to Habermas's way of thinking about knowledge. I think that's going to be very helpful to me. But there's also the way the development of knowledge and working with knowledge is mediated, which is very much at the heart of e-learning. And I'm wondering if where in Habermas's framework one deals with the matter of how the nature of knowledge is interconnected with the media that one used to work with it.
Thanks for that question, Bill. That's a really good question. I actually am not sure whether Habermas discusses that in any great detail at any point in his work. I know, for example, that he gives very little. There's very few points where he discusses technology in all of the things that he's published, which has been quite a bit. And even though Habermas himself points out that, makes the case about the multiplicity of knowledge forms, he often overlooks the way that knowledge is mediated in technologies. So what I would suggest in answer to your question is not necessarily to look to Habermas to provide the key for understanding, these types of questions that arise in e-learning, but rather to consider a range of literature, a range of different types of sources, especially those that go beyond the three types of learning theories or the three or more types of learning theories that I looked at, because what your question points to is the idea that media are important and that knowledge and media interact in ways that are very intricate and that change knowledge and that also impact or affect media as well, examples of places to look for discussions of that would be to look elsewhere in critical theory. There's been a lot of discussion about media and media dynamics in texts of critical theory, and I'd be happy to provide you with some examples of that, and also even just discussions of media in the sense of instructional media, and also not just instructional media, but also sort of social media or mass media and media that people use when they're not learning. Those are really important things to consider in in addressing the question that you raised. So, and again, I'd be happy to provide you with a bit more detail sort of offline about that. I think even, for example, some of the things that Marshall McLuhan said, even though he wouldn't, you know, had very little to do with critical theory, could help to address some of those types of questions. Yeah, and Bill, you just suggested psychosemiotic literature, channels of sense making. I think there's a wide range of possibilities for addressing the type of question that you raised. So let me just go back though and talk about again, kind of perform a bit of a mental experiment here to sort of say, okay, well, what if we took Habermas's three forms of knowledge, his understanding of the multiplicity of knowledge, and just considered some of the very basic repercussions for understanding e-learning. Well, one of them is that education and the use of technology in education can have emancipatory potential. So engaging technology or refusing to engage or to use a particular, let's say, new technology in education and teaching and learning practice is a political act. And it's not simply just a question of technology emancipating its users, which is often, which we're often tempted to think is the case, but rather technology also presenting constraints and limitations on its users. So a simple example of that is classic learning management systems like WebCT or Moodle that impose on users particular roles and functions. And while they would allow people to let's say, learn anywhere, anytime, any place, they are asking the user to and constraining the student to play the role of the student, because all of the functions of the student that are allowed for the student are stated very explicitly in that technology or in the design of those technologies. Of course, another consequence for e-learning is that technical knowledge, which is often the type of knowledge that is seen as being paramount and as defining e-learning in terms of a set of technical practices and a way of implementing technology, still remains very important and very central, but it's only one of three types of knowledge. And then there's the matter of practical knowledge. And as I said at the beginning of the presentation, practical knowledge and practice and practical human interests are actually a lot more complicated and, how should I say it, are a lot more involved than I think we're often led to believe in the way that the term practice is used in e-learning or in discussions of technological implementation. So practice is not simply the implementation or the enactment of, a particular theory or a particular type of technological knowledge. Instead, practice involves things like improvisation, interpretation, making changes to things at the, at the last minute, or people understanding things in very different ways. And I think whether we're researchers or practitioners in e-learning, I think that those types of things will be familiar to us in terms of the way students will present themselves or use or not use, online discussions. I mean, how do they understand it? What's their interpretation of what somebody says in an online discussion? And also in terms of, how a particular group or how an individual takes to online discussion or an online chat. That's a question of not just of technical affordances or of perfecting the design of the technology. It's also a question of practice and of how people understand the technology and how they interpret what they're doing and what others are doing. So practice in this sense becomes an area of importance and for research and reflection and discussion all on its own, just in the same way that it's possible to, and it would make sense according to Habermas's model to talk about emancipatory knowledge and emancipation as as an area of concern all on its own as well. I should also mention, though, that the three areas of knowledge that that Habermas describes, and even the two narrative and logical scientific types of knowledge that someone like Jerome Bruner talks about, they don't talk about these types of knowledge as being, you know, clearly isolated from one another and having nothing to do with each other. They're intertwined, but at the same time, it's important to recognize that you know, just like teaching and learning are intertwined in a course where a student and teacher are highly engaged. These types of knowledge are intertwined in, you know, in any kind of complicated, you know, dialogue or interaction or a thought process. So I already made the first point that, you know, practice is not just the more or less accurate implementation of a theory or a design. We need to think about studying and conceiving of practice on its own, and I think it's especially important to think about this in terms of pedagogical practice, because again, let's say an e-learning program of the type that Richard Meyer and Ruth Colvin Clark describe in terms of a single learner interacting with particular content, their engagement with that involves interpretive processes and a type of practice that the student is bringing to the material, even if there is no other, you know, teacher or anybody else involved in that process. So they come to that material and to the technology not as simply just a sort of a user that's been stripped of you know, all of the cultural knowledge and all of the experience that that they may have had in their past, but rather they come as somebody with all sorts of biases and expectations, or lack of expectations, or and involvements with technology in the past, or lack of involvement, that sort of thing. So again, practice, interpretation, and practical knowledge remains of paramount importance. One could even go so far as to say that practice, especially pedagogical practice, has even a certain authority over theory. It speaks a very different language than theory. And Pierre Bourdieu, who's in some ways a theoretician of practice, above all political practice, has said famously that practice has a logic which is not that of the logician. And I know that this is a distance education forum, and I know that theories of distance education and the notion of theory and the notion of logically constructed theory is often very highly lauded or highly regarded, and is seen to sort of provide the way for distance education. But I would really make the case that that distance educational practice would be a really great way of kind of reorienting or reconceiving or let's say counteracting that emphasis on theory as being the guiding light for ways of understanding distance education as a field. I'm not sure that practice. Well, my understanding of practice that I articulate in this book, and that people like Pierre Bourdieu articulate, is one that says practice is autonomous over theory, and that theory in some ways tries to catch up with practice, and especially when practice involves things like Web 2.0 technologies, social networks, bringing together different people and different combinations of media, then it becomes especially difficult to try to sort of encompass that theoretically. I think that it's okay to sort of say, well, our practice outpaces theory, and that always poses challenges to theory. So what I'll do now is I have a number of slides that I can present, but I see that I've been talking almost nonstop for 45 minutes. So what I'd like to do is open up the floor for questions, and if there is some time to consider some of the questions or the slides that I still have not yet gone through, then I'll certainly turn back to them. But I really would like to hear your thoughts and your comments about what I've been saying, because I've deliberately been trying to say some things that, you know, are a bit provocative, and also, of course, can only touch on a few points in the book. So if there's, you know, things about that you're wondering about in terms of, you know, how I explain things in more detail, or how I understand issues of theory and practice in particular contexts, I'd be really glad to try to answer those. So let me relinquish the mic and let you give you a moment to also think about questions as well.
Please feel free to click on the microphone icon if you have a comment or question, and pose that. Or if you don't, you can text your comment or question.
Hi, Norm. Gail Parcoma here. I have a question for you about action research. Do you take into account its sort of addressing theory through practice at any point in your discussion of what kind of looks like a bit like a dichotomy between theory and practice?
Well, thanks for the question, Gail. I think action research represents a really interesting approach to understanding reconceptualizing or reconfiguring a bit the relationship between theory and practice. That's actually one area that I don't give a lot of coverage to in the book, but I think that it's really significant. I suppose that one of the things that's important, though, in relationship to action research, is that it's significant, and I tried to show in my discussion of psychology, different psychologies and learning theories, and the relationship to our understanding of technology. That in rethinking the relationship between theory and practice, it's important to ask questions about the presuppositions and behind our theories and behind our understandings of practice. And so I think that would be really important to emphasize in working with action research, in at least in keeping it with what I've been saying. In other words, not simply to say, well, how can we use the technology or implement the technology and this learning theory in this classroom setting and then reflect on whether it worked or not, but rather to think also about how one's understanding what might underlie terms like implementing technology and questions about effectiveness in the classroom.
Yeah, I see your point. Let's look at our assumptions before we look at our research strategies. Point well taken. Thanks, Norm.
I just wanted to respond to a really interesting question that was entered in the chat box by Randy Nolan, and he's asking, you know, since you draw on Bourdieu, do you think that things like communities of practice and activity theory might be taking over from cognitivism or constructivism as a background theory? And I think that activity theory and the idea of communities of practice are indeed very interesting. Let me just mention them briefly, or define them briefly. Communities of practice refers to an idea that was developed by Etienne Wenger, and he uses Bourdieu quite a bit, and he looks at how communities are constituted around particular practical interests. And activity theory refers to Wenger talks about how that understanding of communities, practical communities, can be then applied to things like learning and to organizations and institutions. Activity theory refers to the idea of taking a number of different factors into account, including different perspectives of individuals involved, aspects of technology and media, to analyze a particular sort of situation or implementation. And I think both of those approaches represent some really interesting promises. I wouldn't say that I see them as taking over necessarily. I think in some ways, especially for activity theory, it's a bit too early to tell. And I think that the way that the word practice is used in communities of practice and the way that people have talked about community and practice is, well, how should I say this? I suppose we need to understand both of those terms as being things that you can't simply implement, or that that one can't just sort of manipulate as a concept, but rather they're very complicated, and in some ways they can be cultivated, but they can't be instrumentalized. And I think that makes them very challenging to work with, and both conceptually and practically.
Go ahead, Mark. Just click on the microphone.
Thank you. I hope everyone can hear me. I'm not sure quite about my mic adjustment. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Just two questions. I would like to think about the autodidactic learner. I read a lot about communities of learning and connectivism, and really I work in an environment, workplace environment, and we practice e-learning in that context, and communities of learners is not practical, because this is autodidactic scenarios. This is learning on demand, and people want to move ahead in their careers and their levels of certification and licensure at their need, at the time of their need, and at their own pace. So I'm trying to see where this all fits in. As well, I have a question around grounded theory. I've been reading a fair bit about it lately, and I'm just at the point of trying to identify a methodology that might be of interest in my research in learner centricity and usability. It's just a different approach as kind of trying to pull emerging ideas out of reflection on the practices we do, as opposed to deciding on something and trying to determine if it is correct or not. I'd be interested in your thoughts on both of that, where the autodidactic learner fits in and your perspective on grounded theory. Thank you.
Norm, are you having problems with your audio?
Yes, insofar as I forgot to turn the mic on. Sorry about that. Those questions, Mark, are really good. And but in some ways, I'm not quite sure that I can respond to them adequately, because the sort of the self-taught and the self-directed learner is, I think, something that's come to be of like really increasing importance, and I'm not quite sure the context that you're, you know, speaking about it, or that you work, that you're interested in it, or that you're coming from. But with technologies, with Web 2.0 technologies, and the kind of communities that they or groups of people that they facilitate, and practices that are associated with them, directing one's own knowledge and learning informally and that sort of thing all become of increasing importance, and media I think overall have a large role to play in that. So in some ways I can say that remains an outstanding challenge. In terms of grounded theory, again, that's a really interesting question, and I think that grounded theory can play a really interesting role in e-learning research, action research, it's important to really be open to the evidence, whether that's from interviews or from some sort of textual analysis or whatever that is presented to oneself, and to be able to look afresh without theoretical with as few theoretical presuppositions as possible at the evidence that's before one. So those are my comments on those really those two challenging questions.
Norm, there's been a couple of questions posted by Kader regarding whether or not you discuss best practices in e-learning in your book, and also the second question was, do you discuss the future of e-learning in universities? Could you address those, please?
Sure. The first question is, you know, is the answer. My answer to the first question is that yes, I do. I'm concerned mostly with best practices and teaching and learning in post-secondary contexts, and I discuss the relationship between what would be best practices in teaching and how those practices are understood. And how they're researched and how they're conceptualized in research. However, I don't speculate too much on the future of e-learning in universities. One of the reasons for that, in some ways, is that it's such a tricky issue. But what I would say though is that I would be inclined and or my book is sort of based on the premise that there are some established practices and ways that e-learning and educational technology, internet technology, are used in teaching and learning at universities, and that's likely to evolve gradually rather than in any kind of really rapid or revolutionary way. And so I've written my book with the hope that somebody will be able to pick it up in 5 years, and it will speak to the concerns and issues that are still important in post-secondary contexts. And so that's sort of my answer to the question about the future that Connor has raised.
I'm going to take a moment here before we get past the hour to thank you, Norm, for taking the time to share your research and talk to your book here in our CIDR session. We really appreciate the coverage on e-learning research that you've given us. And it's funny, somebody talked about the dichotomy between research and practice earlier, but I don't know so much that it's a dichotomy or a cyclical relationship personally, but anyways, I really appreciate you covering this for us, and I know we didn't get a chance to get through all of your PowerPoint slides here, but I wanted to reassure everybody that they will be posted on the CIDR website if you want to go through those. And I also want to take a moment to, as I mentioned, we've got a lot of researchers in the room here, and I'd like to invite you to share your research at an upcoming CIDR session in the fall. If you're interested in doing so, or if you know of somebody who has some ongoing research that might be willing to share with the CIDR community, please have them contact me. I've just put my email in the text box there, and I'd like to discuss that with people. Finally, I would just like to let everybody know about our next CIDR session with Dr. Jamie Roster, and I believe he's here today. It's going to be a discussion on the challenges of adapting material developed for one online educational setting to another, and that's going to take place on Wednesday, June 3rd at 11 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time. I believe I have on the slide there that Dr. Rossiter is from the University of Oxford. I have to make it clear that the study was done while he was there, and he is currently now with the Public Health Agency of Canada. So we're looking forward to that presentation and hoping you can all be there to join us. So thank you very much, Norm, for your presentation today, and thank you to all the participants who took time to join us.